Thank you, sir. My name is Mary Wilfred, and I am from St. Lucia. We're looking at public health this morning, and there are three presentations to be made. The first one is by Jeffrey St. Bernard, University of the West Indies, Trinidad and Tobago. And he will be examining sustaining the future well-being of our children, an empirical analysis of breastfeeding practices in Trinidad and Tobago. I think he is the first gentleman seated there. Our second presenter is Dindyal Ramrotan, and is also from the University of the West Indies, Trinidad and Tobago, and he'll be examining the case for preventative approach to chronic non-communicable diseases in Trinidad and Tobago. And our last presenter, who has just asked me to identify her as Fumi, will be looking at health impact assessment of St. Mary's Island, a rapid HIA of a housing project. So let's give our presenters a round of applause, even though they've not started, but we just to they've graced us with their work this morning. And without further ado, I am going to call on Mr. St. Bernard with his presentation.
Okay, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to be speaking to you about sustaining the future of well-being of our children, an empirical analysis of breastfeeding practices in Trinidad and Tobago. And as far as the rationale for the study goes, children should be the principal targets of intervention in our trust to sustain future well-being at the national level. And I'm speaking about this because I'm taking a dynamic approach rather than a static approach and really looking into the future and what we are doing now and how it would impact upon what happens in the future. Children need a good start in life. The first 36 months constitute the most critical years of their lives insofar as experiences in this period may determine life experiences and fortunes at later stages of childhood and undoubtedly in adolescent and adult stages of their lives. Hence, there is a need to preserve children's health and facilitate their meaningful education. However, their nutrition is central to such goals. Notwithstanding gains due to late achievement, whether in the context of improved health, educational advancement, or overall human development, Bellamy in 2001 contends that deprivation in the early years of life has a deleterious effect on children, preventing them from attaining their full potential. To this end, worthy interventions targeting children to minimize such deprivation include the promotion of good hygiene and sanitation practices, the sustenance of immunization programs, the observance of proper feeding practices, fostering improved physical growth, early detection and subsequent treatment of disabilities, and the practice of breastfeeding as a psychosocial stimulant. So, what then are some of the benefits of breastfeeding? And I'm looking at this in the context of child nutrition and the impact it has on other aspects of children's growth and development into adolescents and adults. And according to several biomedical studies, breastfeeding has been associated with a host of benefits, including stronger immunity to diseases, reduced prospects of infant and child mortality, superior intellectual and motor skills development, enhanced psychosocial stimulation, and greater probabilities of survival into adulthood. What are some of the breastfeeding standards that we should be familiar with? And a lot of what I'm talking about comes out of the multiple indicator cluster surveys that have been done around the world looking at the status of children in a number of developing countries, including some of those in the Caribbean. And the World Fit for Children goal states that children should be exclusively breastfed for 6 months and continue to be breastfed with safe, appropriate, and adequately complementary feeding for up to 2 years of life and beyond. What I show you here is going to give you a sense of how some of the empirical work that I eventually do, how some of the variables were actually operationalized. And insofar as I'm looking at children in the first 2 years of life, we look at those 6 to 11 months as one group, those under 1 year, and then those in the second year of life between 12 months and 23 months. And you can see when you look at the adequate feeding standards that there is some variability in terms of what is considered to be adequate feeding standards. The purpose of the study, or the purposes of the study, go as follows. One is really to describe variable patterns of breastfeeding that children are exposed to during the first 2 years of life, and to advance strategies that would facilitate breastfeeding practices tantamount to the World Fit for Children goals. The research questions basically are as follows. What is the prevalence of breastfeeding and its variability across critical age groups in the context of children during the first 24 months of their lives? For such children, which subpopulations of children exhibit the most favorable and least favorable exposure to breastfeeding, bearing in mind international recommendations? Then, which children's characteristics, if any, emerge as significant in targeting efforts toward more favorable breastfeeding practices? And this particular question seeks to bring to bear inferential statistical approaches to test some of the patterns that have emerged out of preliminary cross-tabular analyses to see to what extent they hold and are reliable and so on. In terms of the data, as I said, were obtained from the multiple indicator cluster survey done in Trinidad and Tobago in 2006. That was a national household survey targeting households, women, children, and caregivers to gauge the status of children spatially and temporally. But as far as the children under two go, we are talking here about a national sample yielding 424 cases pertaining to infants under 2 years. And some of the principal criterion variables which were central to the study were those looking at the proportion never breastfed, the proportion still breastfeeding, and the proportion adequately breastfed. In terms of some of the principal factors that impacted upon these criterion variables, we look at the age group of children, the region of residence, mother's education, socioeconomic status, and the sex of the child. And if you look on the screen, you would see some preliminary results in terms of how the respective population is distributed. If I go to the next slide, you would see some more there in terms of some of the purely demographic characteristics in terms of the number of children, the distribution of children, and so on. And of course, by socioeconomic status, since we are talking about quintiles, it's almost evenly distributed in all of the quintiles. You can see that there's slightly more males than females in the sample. And if I go back, you can see the distribution in the first year and second year of life. We're talking about almost an even split, if not an even split. And the majority of the cases came from central Trinidad, with the southwest and the northwest having the next highest proportions, and Tobago having the smallest proportion. And you can see that most of the children had mothers with lower secondary education. So that gives you a quick sense of the distribution of the children according to characteristics associated with their background. The next slide gives you a sense of the breastfeeding characteristics. You can see that 88.4% were ever breastfed, which meant 11.6 were never breastfed. Still breastfeeding, 45.8%, and adequately breastfed, 21.2%. And this is with respect to children under 2 years. Now, this table, what I realized is that the subheading at the top was cut off, but the leftmost column really speaks to proportion never breastfed. The second column treats with the proportion still breastfeeding. The third one, the proportion adequately breastfed. And the fourth one, of those who are still breastfeeding, what proportion is adequately breastfed? So this would give you a sense. And a lot of the preliminary statements I make are based upon what you see contained in those tables, in this table. So I will keep this table there for a while as I go through a sort of narrative in terms of what this table is referring to. Now, if you look at this table, what you would see is that with respect to children under 2 years, breastfeeding exposure was most favorable among those living in the Tobago region and least favorable among those living in the Southwest region. What you'll also see is that male children under 2 years were more likely than their female counterparts to have never been breastfed. But at the same time, when you look at the other side of it in terms of those adequately breastfed, what you would find is that males, on the other hand, were more likely to be adequately breastfed than their female counterparts. The table also shows that children were most likely to have been adequately fed if their mothers had a minimum of a university education, notwithstanding this fact, a noteworthy proportion of children whose mothers had at least a university education was estimated to have never been breastfed. And this has some implications that I will talk to in a while. In contrast, children were most likely to have never been breastfed if their mother had not attained higher than a primary level education. And this has implications in terms of education and outcomes in terms of breastfeeding practices. There is a positive association. When you look at the table, what you can see when you look at socioeconomic status and whether or not those who were still breastfeeding were adequately breastfed, what you would see is that there is a positive association between socioeconomic status and the proportion of children adequately breastfed among those who were still breastfeeding. However, a negative association has been observed between socioeconomic status and children's lifetime exposure to breastfeeding. The latter is important and suggests that the aforementioned positive association might be indicative of a small but committed core of children born to better educated mothers who are fully aware of the benefits to be derived from adhering to recommended standards, and as such, have embraced such standards much more so than their counterparts in lower socioeconomic status groups. At the other extreme, children from the poorest households have been observed to be the least likely to have never breastfed, while their counterparts from the wealthiest households were estimated to be more than twice as likely to have never been breastfed. In essence, they were more likely than children from any other quintile group to have never been breastfed. And this is something that is observed in terms of those coming from the wealthier households. Still looking at this table, what we can see is that there are consistent that the findings themselves in the table are consistent with noteworthy gaps between proportions still breastfeeding and proportions adequately fed. So if you look at the difference between the second column and the third column, you would see that the proportions in the second column are consistently higher than those in the third column. And this is the case irrespective of children's sex, their region of residence, their mother's education, and their socioeconomic status. Ideally, proportions still breastfeeding should assume greater magnitudes than those observed, and at the same time, be equivalent. They should either be less than. They should be greater than they are. The proportion still breastfeeding. They should be greater. I'm getting a little thing here. Let me backtrack. Yeah, what I'm saying basically is that the proportion still breastfeeding should assume greater magnitudes than those that are observed there, and at the same time be equivalent to the proportions adequately breastfed. Now, insofar as the available evidence show greater proportions still breastfeeding than being adequately breastfed, one may conclude that such observations reflect ignorance of recommended standards and their underlying criteria among mothers who have still been breastfeeding. On examining Table 4, ignorance of recommended standards and underlying criteria may not be as great among mothers living in the wealthiest households as and those with at least university education. And here what we are speaking about are those who find themselves among a committed few who understand and are aware of the approved standards. Now I want to move to Table 5, which treats with some of the inferential statistics. And here I use a multivariate technique called logistic regression. And what I'm doing is really looking at, you know, whether children are exposed to being still breastfed or not, and whether children are adequately breastfed or not. And what this shows is that relative to those children who are in their second year of life, the probability of still being breastfed among children under 6 months is greater by a factor of 15. And in the case of those under between 6 and 11 months, it is greater by a factor of 3. For all the other factors, however, there is insufficient evidence from the data that were collected to suggest that each has any significant impact on the probability of still being breastfed. So we're looking here at the whole notion of being breastfed or not, and the only variable that has come out as having a significant impact is the age of the children. Otherwise, I think, you know, the sample is a bit too small to perhaps bring out the fact that perhaps other factors could be having significant impact on whether children are still breastfed or not. When it comes now to the other model, Model 3, which looks at whether they are adequately breastfed or not, again, the evidence is insufficient to support a statistically significant impact. And again, this has to do with the small sample size that could be affecting these outcomes. So in sort of concluding now, what I'd like to do is just make some quick statements about some main implications and point to some policy recommendations. Based on what we have seen so far, there does not appear to be a significant adherence to internationally recommended breastfeeding standards in Trinidad and Tobago. This could be a function of a host of sociocultural stimuli that threaten mothers' inclination to continue breastfeeding for recommended periods and a lack of knowledge about recommended breastfeeding standards. Such factors seem overwhelmingly manifest and collectively impact negatively on the breastfeeding of children under 2 years. Thus, the vast majority of infants have ceased being breastfed by their first birthday. This means that there is need to discern opportunistic and motivational factors that impact such an outcome, especially if antecedent cultural nuances exist. This can only be accomplished through further research that embraces qualitative research designs. It is also important that future research initiatives target specific larger samples of young children under 2 years to permit the generation of more reliable estimates. Such samples should permit tests of hypotheses borne out by preliminary observations emerging from this study. And I'm saying basically, if the samples were larger, perhaps some of the evidence that seemed to be supported by the cross-tabular data would be supported by the inferential statistical analysis and produce more reliable outcomes as far as the factors impacting on breastfeeding practices are concerned. In the final analysis, I just want to say that these findings do have some implications and for recommendations in the area of public education regarding issues of breastfeeding, perhaps, you know, the establishment of nurseries and crèches in workplaces and in universities and such places, and legislation targeting labeling and marketing of breast milk alternatives and so on. And I have also been thinking perhaps, you know, there's need to consider the fact that breastfeeding does increase the length of time between subsequent births, and if it is that there are differences associated with levels of education and socioeconomic status, there's a whole range of issues that could emerge in terms of, you know, those subpopulations that may be maybe inclined to having larger numbers of children, and perhaps how we can perhaps get them to space and have fewer children if in the event that is deemed to be a worthy outcome for them. So at this point, I think I'll stop and pass on to the next presenter. Thank you.
Okay, good morning. The work that has been done here focuses primarily on the case for a preventative approach towards the treatment of non-communicable chronic disease. The recognition was made that we tend to be so responsive when it comes to infectious diseases that occur at a once in a point to sort of attitude, that we tend to forget the diseases we tend to live with throughout the time. And where there's the real need is that we need to recognize these diseases lead to a breakdown, not only at an initial period, but throughout our working life, throughout the human capital development of a country. Now, the data is primarily focused on Trinidad and Tobago to recognize the changing epidemiological pattern that has been taking place throughout the country. And we have made some analysis of some Caribbean data that was presented to show that the one thing we've noticed with non-communicable diseases, especially the chronic non-communicable diseases, is that they exhibit the same patterns. So we would look at the Caribbean data and we would see that the Trinidad and Tobago data is almost identical in terms of the trend over a 20-year period. But before we go there, we would look at what's taking place globally. The WHO report has forecasted that chronic diseases would be the leading cause of disability by the year 2020. Now, such a forecast means disability is something where, apart from having current course to continue to live at a certain level, you would be restricted in your ability to add to the human capital development of your country. So countries have got to be mindful of the fact that there is a sort of shift in the dynamics of the health sectors And there needs to be a recognition. If we deal with this earlier, we may prevent any real damages taking place. And one example of that damage would be the fact that the same report alluded to the cost associated with the loss of production due to diabetes is 5 times greater than the healthcare cost to treat with diabetes. Now, if we are to look at this in the broad macroeconomic perspective and we have to take into account multiplier effect and these sort of conditions, we recognize what really takes place. And this is one chronic disease. And in the Caribbean, diabetes is not, I don't want to say not yet as a profit, but it is not yet the leading cause of death when we refer to chronic diseases. The global healthcare systems, as I said earlier, are responsive in nature, but I believe that has more to do with the fact that they treated with their main predominance is infectious diseases, which are treated in a responsive way. Brazil, USA, and India with their success stories. The one success story I'd like to point out is in the USA in California. Where they specialize in treating with chronic disease, they were able to find a model in which the cost per capita of treating with the disease was equivalent to that of the UK. But at the same time, the access, the treatment, and the service being offered was considered far superior when compared with the same UK hospitals. When we look at the Caribbean region now, this is just a short snapshot type of timeline to show that infectious diseases would have been the main trend of thought into the 1970s. At this point, success was being registered and that there was a reduction in the impact that infectious diseases were having within the economies of the Caribbean. However, 1980s would have been the advent of the HIV/AIDS. We see 1983 was the first case of HIV/AIDS in Trinidad. It is now accounting for 4% of total deaths in the country. Right, just to show you the brief timeline and what has already happened with that. Chronic non-communicable diseases would have come to the fore in the 1990s. The difference between HIV/AIDS and this trend of diseases is that although HIV/AIDS is chronic, it is not non-communicable. It is, in fact, communicable. So that's why it would have been separated throughout. If we now go to some of the data from the Caribbean, I'd like you to take special notice of heart disease, which is the leading cause of death, but is in a downward trend. One of the main reasons for this is that when we consider primary, secondary, and tertiary preventative type treatments, heart disease is able to be treated at each stage. Secondary, especially, where once you know you may be suffering from heart disease, there are steps you can take to impact its impact on you. However, the problem when we look at cancer and its rise is that once diagnosed with cancer, there tends to be, unless you are able to access the treatment, the effects tend to take hold. And also look at the pattern that is going on with diabetes. Diabetes is one of the chronic diseases that you tend to build up over time. And this, remember, these figures are the mortality rate. So these are the persons who have died from the diseases. Now, if we had to factor in what percentage are still living with the disease, we tend to see a greater trend. Looking at the impact, just to make mention of HIV/AIDS to show you what's taking place there, we look at 1985 where it's at, and we look at the rise it has already had by the year 2000 in the Caribbean. Now, please take a little snapshot of heart disease, cancers, and diabetes mellitus and the trends as we look at now the Trinidad case. Heart disease in this case is the green line to the top. If you notice, it's the almost identical trend in that it was increasing up until the 2000s, started to decrease. But in Trinidad and Tobago, look at the vast difference in the... This graph looks at number of deaths. And look at the vast difference in the number of deaths between heart disease and any other of the leading cause of mortality. We see diabetes mellitus, yet again the same upward trend and in a progressive rate. And we are seeing the malignant neoplasms or your cancers that is showing yet again the same trend, going upward, there was a minor decrease. The fear with cancers, however, is that since we cannot fully establish the cause of certain cancers, since we are still plugging around with different treatment plans, cancers could actually take a turn either for the plenty better or for the plenty worse. And that's one of the biggest fears. But heart disease, which should be one of the easiest to treat with, is still the leading cause of death by quite a margin. And that's something that as a country where the spending is taking place in the health sector, is it directed towards the diseases that are causing the problems, or are we having health sector spending that isn't exactly targeting what it should be? This is the allocations for core social sector ministries for the Trinidad and Tobago in the 2008-2009 fiscal. It may be a little difficult to make out, I'm sorry for that, but if we look, health receives $2.9 billion of recurrent expenditure, second only to education. Now, just to inform you, education in Trinidad and Tobago is treated with great pomp. There is up to free tertiary level education, and there are aids in terms of loans and facilities for students while studying. So imagine, even with all these facilities available through the education sector, we are just seeing roughly a 0.3 billion difference in spending between education and health. But are we seeing the benefits of the spending in the health sector if we are not able to control with the diseases that should be easily manageable and we know are in presence? When we look at some of the healthcare measures of the country, there is the CDAP, which is the Chronic Disease Assistance Program. This program is in place and is fully funded by the government for certain drugs. I believe it's 53 pharmaceutical items for 12 different diseases. The government records at the operational plan up until 2010 suggested there were 580,000 cases of persons accessing drugs under CDAP. However, the Health Economics Unit of the University of the West Indies estimates that these 580,000 cases of access represented 200,000 persons. The reason for the difference would be some persons would access more than one drug, and we have some drugs that, although they are used in chronic diseases, they also use for other diseases. So thus, we're working with that. There are policies we have on youth policies, aging policies, sport policies that, apart from identifying certain other variables within the economy, do help in the preventative measures when it comes to lifestyle diseases. The passage of the Tobacco Control Act, which was a major piece of legislation in the fight against chronic diseases, especially cancers, was laid in 2009. Now, this was deemed in Parliament upon being laid as one of the major instruments by the government to try to tackle with some of these chronic diseases facing the country. Up till now, we will have little success stories to speak of because of the recency of this initiative. We also see breathalyzer testing. Apart from road accidents, alcohol abuse in the country is suggestively on a progressive rise, and this could possibly be a minor speed bump in dealing with that. When we look now at the impact of the chronic diseases on the country, what we have to recognize is that the health of the population not only impacts on the production possibilities of the country, but there's a reverse reaction in terms of welfare. Welfare payments being made due to disability, due to various other conditions, tend to be on the rise when you allow chronic diseases to get out of control. So apart from having to have greater expenditure, you're also now going to lose in the productive capacity. And with losing persons from the workforce at an earlier age, you tend to be able to produce less and you lose taxation revenues. So this model, which was presented by Meadover in 92, remains applicable, especially to Trinidad example. However, one thing I'd like to suggest is that we need to take into consideration the relationship between the health of the population and the expenditure of the population. Because whenever a large part of the budget needs to go behind health needs, drugs, any sort of treatment, what we could see is a loss in savings or a loss in investment opportunities within the economy. And this would further exacerbate the situation. These are just some of the concerns we spoke about, and the need to invest in preventative measures, especially for the welfare payments within the country. Although healthcare is free, some of the barriers we see taking place is, one, the cost to travel to and from healthcare facilities, and especially for the lower socioeconomic groupings, the loss of earnings when they have to seek treatment. Because apart from not being able to go to work for the treatment, a lot of times, preventative healthcare, you tend to have to lay back at a period where you feel you can work. And with the lower socioeconomic groupings, who probably get paid by the daily rates, get paid by the day or even weekly, they tend to trade off the rest period or the treatment period because they still need to go out and make a living. And the cultural perceptions with respect to health within some of the rural communities, you still hear the statement, you shouldn't cut anything, meaning you shouldn't go for surgery, and it's something that certain groupings still believe in. So if the preventative health care has to take place and it means probably some form of surgery, they already think of it in an adverse manner. And just to wrap it up, what we are seeing we need for is this collaborative approach towards healthcare, where we need to recognize that it's not only the health sector being affected, it is across the board. And once we have anything that needs that sort of treatment, all sectors should also join hands to come forth and find the solutions. Preventative measures also need to be context specific. We cannot be treating with preventative healthcare. We can't be treating with chronic diseases in the manner that we may treat with infectious diseases and wait for the rates to go up or wait to see more cases. Because a lot of times when you see more cases appearing on the books, it means under the water, the iceberg is a lot larger, and we need to treat with that. And we have seen in the developed and developing world that preventative healthcare is a cost-effective and efficient method, and it goes without saying that there should be some analysis of its introduction within the Caribbean economies, especially Trinidad and Tobago. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. My name is Fumi Odunyi. My full name is a sentence, Olufumilayo, which my parents named me because they said God gave them joy. But they don't call me that unless they're very angry with me. Okay. A bit about myself. I'm a pharmacist with a special interest in diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular risk. I have an MBA from the Imperial College, and I undertake a lot of consultancy work in addition to my lecturing job. I came here with the expectation of speaking about one of the jobs I did for a primary care organization, about the role of pharmacists in the prevention of obesity. However, yesterday I discovered from the program that my other abstract is the preferred one for this presentation, so I was advised wrongly. So you will forgive me because these slides were prepared last night after a long day, but I'll do my best. Okay, the title is Health Impact Assessment of St. Mary's Island, a rapid health impact assessment of a housing project with a focus on obesity prevention. The previous speaker has set the pace for me because he has identified that non-communicable diseases are a big problem, and obesity is indeed one big one because it is one of the biggest causes of diabetes. So much is this a problem that in the UK and in the US, a word, diabesity, has now been coined, which is diabetes coexisting with obesity being the primary cause. It seems a little bit inappropriate to be talking about obesity given the current situation that is happening in St. Lucia. However, we have to consider that, you know, malnutrition and overnutrition coexist in many countries, including the Caribbean. I decided to check last night what studies have been done in the Caribbean, and I found a study by Professor Bonte of the University of West Indies Mona campus about diabetes and about the high prevalence of diabetes in the Caribbean. I also found that the WHO has identified that the Caribbeans are also going through the obesity epidemic. It's not obvious when I look at the beautiful ladies I see around here, and in my hotel, everybody looks perfect, but it is a problem. Ah, the gents as well. Well, I look at the ladies more. Right, health. We all know that the quality of life and health is directly influenced by the environment, economic factors, and social factors. And as such, health needs to be integrated into all policies. There was talk today about the impact assessment of what is happening at the moment in St. Lucia, the after effects of the hurricane. It is important to emphasize, as we are looking at the environmental impact, we must also be looking at the health impact of these problems. Sustainable development tends to be said to have three pillars. Hence, sometimes you see it as a house or a three-legged stool: economic, environmental, and social issues. Those are the same factors I mentioned are relevant to obesity. Sustainable development is about meeting the needs of the present population without compromising the health of and or the life of the future generation. I dare say that obesity is a threat to sustainable development. The WHO has classified obesity as a chronic disease and a global epidemic. It is indeed a public health problem, and in the UK, it has been said to be a time bomb. If it is a time bomb, then it means it's not only affecting us, it's going to affect the future generations. It is both a cause and a consequence of economic problems, and I'll explain that. In the UK particularly, it is a problem that is defined solutions, and you'll see why I said that. This beautiful picture shows the global picture of obesity, showing the different countries such as the USA, Mexico, the UK, and other countries like Korea, who are low, and there are different flags, the country's flags, shown as bugs. The UK comes third on the list, although this data is from about 4 years ago, so it's getting a little bit dated. You can see that Sweden has a very relatively low obesity level, and that is associated with their less obesogenic environment. How big a problem is obesity in England? Well, it is very big. In 1992, it was recognized as a problem, and there was a target to reduce obesity to 6 to 8% by 2005. 6% in men and 8% in women by 2005, and policies were put into place. However, what was found was that by 2002, about 22 to 23% of men and women were obese, and 65% of men and 56% of women were overweight or obese combined. And it's getting higher by the day. Basically, obesity has trebled since the 80s in the UK. And you can see why I say it's defying all efforts to stop it. I propose that poverty is a big cause of obesity in the UK. In the developed world, it's a different matter. But in the UK, certainly, it is a problem. There's financial poverty. People cannot afford to go to the gym. They cannot afford to go to the green places. And healthy food costs more. Fruits and vegetables are so much more expensive than crisps and such things. There's the poverty of time, where there is no time to prepare meals, no time to sit and eat together as a family, no time for the children, hence children go without breakfast, no time for leisure, and they need to put in excessive hours. There are also special challenges where people who are the poorest live in high-rise buildings and they can't go down, they don't even want to, they consider that they live in a stressful, worrying environment, they are actually afraid to take walks in case they are attacked. I came across this, and while it's funny, it's a joke, it's not really a joke to me, because I see the impact of obesity in my studies and my work. It says tips for staying healthy. You can consider that tips for avoiding obesity, a social determinants approach. Don't be poor. If you can, stop being poor. If you can't, try not to be poor for too long. Don't have poor parents. Don't live in a poor neighborhood. You probably won't be able to go for your walks. Own a car, but use it only for weekends. Walk to work. Practice not losing your job, and don't become unemployed. Don't be illiterate. Avoid social isolation. I didn't write it, and I've acknowledged the author, but it's quite pertinent. In the UK, it's been found that people who are in the higher socioeconomic ladder are more likely to go cycling, whereas people in the lower economic end, which are the group E, are less likely to go cycling in a typical week. Beyond that, it has also been found that people of lower socioeconomic grades are likely not to visit the parks. So they visit parks and green spaces infrequently, whereas the more wealthy people have more access to the green space and they do visit. So they go walking and exercising their dogs and all such things. The social gradient in obesity is particularly high in females. It's also evident in men, but there is a gender bias. And so my friend, Professor Niles, who said I didn't mention men, maybe I look more out more for women. Women have a higher rate of obesity and the social gradient is higher. You can see that the people of a professional status have more or less stayed the same, whereas at the top end, the people of a lower socioeconomic income are the most obese and they're the ones also going higher at a steeper gradient. So the social gradient is widening. Why am I worried? The health consequences of obesity have long been recognized. I mean, in Shakespeare, Falstaff said, "Thou seest that I have more flesh than another man, and therefore more frailty." These are some of the consequences of obesity, right from head to toe, basically. Stroke, respiratory disease, including sleep apnea, heart disease, gallbladder disease, cardiovascular risk factors. However, diabetes is the biggest one, and my previous speaker has emphasized that. A study by Bonte, which I mentioned, really focused on diabetes in the Caribbean and said about 18% prevalence exists at the moment. The economic consequences of obesity in the UK are really dire. From about 500 million in 1998, it has gone up to direct cost of about 1 billion in short, to the NHS, and a total of 6 to 7 billion annually to the system. That is actually an underestimate. And when you consider the current economic climate, it's going to go up more, but there isn't any money to spare, basically. As people get poorer and their disposable incomes become less, then the obesity crisis will even plummet even more. It was said in the news recently that the NHS will need to buy new beds and chairs to cope with the changing demographics of patients. It's funny, but it's not, you know. It's just the fact. They have to buy new beds, they have to buy new chairs, and you can imagine also from a sustainable development issue, what happens to the old ones? Do we dispose of them? There are other public health consequences, as has been said before me. 30,000 avoidable deaths, of which 9,000 are premature deaths. Life expectancy is reduced by 9 years. And it's also associated with adverse environmental effects. It's been said in a recent study that 40% prevalence of obesity increases the need for more food energy and energy expenditure. So we decided to evaluate the health impacts of a built environment. A health impact assessment is the evaluation of a policy or a project or a program for the potential effects on the health of a population and to evaluate the relative distribution of these effects within the population, obviously with a view to mitigate the negatives and enhance the positives. Looking at it from the point of view that health is a complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being, not just the absence of disease. There are several policy contexts which allude to the fact that housing is a very important aspect of health. And one of these is a sustainable community policy, and the other is a chosen health policy, which the government tries to encourage people to promote healthy choices. St. Mary's Island is actually You could call it a man-made island, but before now it had existed more as a dump yard. A lot of it was a brownfield site, and toxic waste was in it. It exists in Chatham, and it was actually built about 10 years ago. Chatham is actually located in a town called Medway, and it is actually plagued with socioeconomic downturn. It was a shipping site years ago, but they lost all that because the dockyard was closed, and as a result, there was severe economic decline. And there is a term, a chav. A chav is actually, it's on this place in the dictionary now, and it's a derogatory term for aggressive teenagers from a white working class background who engage in antisocial behavior. Chatham is the heart of chavs, and that word chav came from Chatham Average. So you can imagine the deprivation in Medway. But St. Mary's Island was built to try and alleviate some of this deprivation. And the health of Medway has been found to be really bad, worse than the average. There are severe health inequalities. Most people do not go to university, hence the university where I work is one of the new developments to try and improve the situation in Medway. It was actually developed from two universities coming together, basically. Employment is high. Unemployment, rather, is quite high. 10% below the average is what they earn in Medway. And deprivation is extremely high. In fact, deprivation and affluence coexist in Medway. For example, St. Mary's Island is highly affluent, whereas within the same ward, we have a lot of poor people. My research question was, what are the health impacts of living on this built environment, and what potential does it hold for improving the health and reducing the prevalence of obesity? Basically, the methodology was a rapid health impact assessment with a focus on the promises it holds to tackle obesity and consequently contribute to the sustainable development agenda. We used qualitative and quantitative methods, interviewing key informants and using data from secondary sources. Basically, I'm going to have to go quickly because I realize that I probably have about 5 minutes left. The environmental conditions are highly positive. It's an attractive area, good living conditions. There is the ability to engage in physical activity because there's a lot of green space. However, we found that the roads are not well lit. And because there are lack of cameras, people are worried. Therefore, even though the facilities exist, many people still drive their children to school, while the children could really walk to school. There's very poor public transportation to the stations and shops. Therefore, people end up using their cars when really they could walk. And so the other fact we found was that vulnerable groups, such as the elderly and the disabled, and the visually impaired, were not catered for within the island. Poor road markings and a lot of inconsideration, basically. The economic impacts, well, it was found that the wages in Medway are very poor and there are not a lot of well-paid jobs. And as such, a lot of the residents of St. Mary's Island have to travel out to work. And so the quality of life that they could really have is lost in the disposable income for traveling and the loss of time. Remember I said you could have a poverty of time because you may be living in a beautiful place, but you haven't got the time to actually enjoy it. There are a lot of renters, key workers, because of the aspiration to live in the good environment, but the trouble with that is they are not as settled because it's not their home, and they are paying a lot of money to live there. So basically they remain poor and they eat poorly. Basically, the lifestyle advantages of a built environment include the possibility of social inclusion, access to physical activity, and a positive lifestyle for all groups. However, we found segregation of groups, with renters feeling excluded, and potentially they had a poor diet because there were no good shops locally. It was really made for people with cars. These are some of the quotes we got. The place is so beautiful that they said, it's as though we are not in Medway. It's a haven from Chatham. Remember, it's actually in Chatham. It's wonderful as a retreat after work, a great sense of tranquility, safe holiday atmosphere. So many people said it felt like being on holiday. However, we also found some negative comments. I feel that the Housing Association is really for people with a lower income and their housing is subsidized. But people feel that they should not be allowed to live on an island that is for this exclusive few. So I feel that the Housing Association people should not be allowed to live on what is an exclusive area that people have paid a premium to buy. The promised lifestyle hasn't materialized. Local area needs a lot of development to come to the standard of St. Mary's Island. Some social issues were found. Some people said it was a lonely place. Someone said there are a lot of snobs. And you could tell because somebody said, we don't know if they are illegal immigrants. So that is to say that when they look at it's about 95% white, non-white people, they consider that they could be immigrants. And so they're not well accepted. And social inclusion is part of sustainability and feeling that you are, welcome where you live, basically. And there's a lot of uncertainty. Somebody said the island will become saturated with houses. In the 1960s, lovely safe estates were built, only for them to breed crime and social problems. Give it 15 to 20 years, I fully expect the island to be of a similar downfall. Look at the rest of Chatham. So linking it to Chatham. Basically, the report shows that there are opportunities that this island holds to improve the health of the residents, especially in reducing obesity. However, it highlights a lot of health concerns which are not health service related. We recommended better public transport, encouraging more walking, a lot of buses, at least to the station, so that people can actually travel without driving, improving access to services, managing people's expectations about the island so that they don't become uncertain, and improvement of the local community. Without the local community actually improving, there will be a wider gap in the social gradient, and there will be more inequality and really inequity. The health status should be the concern of all policymakers, not merely those who work in the health sector. I'm sure that a lot of people listening to me today may not necessarily work in the health sector, but I plead with you that as you consider your various policies in your different organizations, you think about health and how whatever policy you are involved with, be it education, transportation, affects the health of the people. Thank you very much.
Thank you, presenters, for your excellent work and for those who are probably still continuing to do the research. It's now your opportunity to ask questions, and we will take probably three or so at a time, and then it is going to be another round. Is there a microphone that can go around the table? Thank you. Our first question is right up here, our second and third question. So, presenters, be alert.
Can you hear me?
No. Could you?
Okay. Well, I can now. Yeah. Is it on? Okay. The question is for Funmi. I enjoyed all of the presentations, mm-hmm. but especially to Funmi because it's related to what I'm starting to get into. You mentioned that obesity in places like the UK are a result of poverty, and you talked about the dual burden of obesity and undernutrition, which exists all around the world. But you said something about it being the inverse relationship in the developing world, okay? Which is a question that I'm starting to look at myself in a more cultural sense. But I would like to
find out more about that.
Okay. Could you just hold on a second, please? Second question.
My question is for Mr. Ramaratan. I'm wondering, in light of what I myself am researching, has your study considered that one barrier to accessing healthcare may be based on the need of individuals to seek invisibility, given the cultural and or legal exclusions based on objections to their sexuality, and that in itself mitigates against attempts at the possibility of identifying, let alone treating chronic non-communicable diseases, for example, colon cancer, ergo impacting negatively a state's economy from the standpoint of diagnosis and treatment at the critical juncture of the terminal stage.
This is quite a long question. Were you typing, Daniel? All right, he said he was typing. Okay, we'll take the last one and then they'll respond.
Okay, my question is for Funmi. It's a two-part thing. In terms of the factors for obesity, how much does genetics come into play? And also, what are the exercise options for those who are in lower socioeconomic classes then? Because yes, higher classes have access to gyms, but what kind of activities can people from lower classes have access to?
Okay, I think I'll be sympathetic to Mr. Ramaratan since his question is very long. So we'll have you to respond first.
Okay, well, with regards to confidentiality and healthcare, I think there isn't much studies available currently in terms of how it's treated in Trinidad and Tobago. But it brings my mind back to when Professor Bartholomew from the Medical Research Center was speaking to HIV/AIDS. He said that of the persons coming into the center with the disease for the first time, close to 40% of them were at the late stage of the disease. Which means, I think, before we even go into confidentiality concerns in Trinidad, we have to look at whether people do go for the checks to even know that the disease is present. And with regards to types of cancers, I think the country as a whole has become more sensitive to it. There isn't the educational awareness with cancers, and I think that's probably what masks it a little bit, because a lot of times we hear people say cancer, and they wouldn't go into the types such as colon, prostate, or lung cancer. So that sort of disparity isn't there, but I think the general consensus would be the awareness within the country needs to be uplifted to get this sort of the understanding from the general population. In regards to surveys and studies being done, I can't say that I know of any offhand that would have dealt with the questions to know what was the willingness to respond with regards to certain diseases. Hope that helps.
Yes, sir.
I've just responded as a psychologist. I find that within the last maybe 5 years, and it's something I maybe need to research and to take more notes in terms of making an assessment here, but I find within those last 5 years, a lot of people are coming for counseling or for therapy because they have these non-communicable diseases and they want to be able to cope with them. Before, there was a lot of confidentiality, invisibility. People didn't say, they would come and say, well, I'm not well, and you will treat them for depression or you'll treat them and you'll work through and ask questions and nobody will say until maybe about the fifth or maybe after they have left, you hear, oh, they had some disease. But there's much more confession now in that area, and I think this will help me. I think I'm going to plug this in and maybe run with it a little bit. It's something I took for granted, but as you mentioned it, I recognize now that there's much more openness and much more people come, many more people come in for that type, even down to that people who are doing tux and lap, what's it, that bio, what's that? Life, no, not that, the, yeah, that one. When they tie the stomach, yeah. Okay. Anything like that. People come into, even for that now, people are not saying, I'm afraid to do it or I don't do it. It's been very much more popular, open.
All right. Thank you. You okay with that? Okay. We'll come back. All right. Fumi, it's all yours now.
Respond to the first question about the fact whether obesity is associated with poverty or not in the developing countries. I have done some studies in sub-Saharan Africa, and what I have found is that, for one thing, there are cultural issues, there are issues that have to do with perception, body image, and it is generally believed that, you know, a little bit of corpulence is associated with wealth. So therefore, you find that the wealthier people tend to indulge more. There is the need, they feel the need to associate with Western lifestyle. So you see the equivalent of McDonaldization, where people go for what, for example, in Nigeria, Mr. Biggs and all those things. There is a poverty of time, not the poverty of money, where people, for example, bankers, I've done a lot of work with bankers and people in the urban areas, who have a very stressful, busy life. They make a lot of money. They drop the money for the children who go and buy the McDonald's and what have you for breakfast. They haven't got the time to actually see that the children eat healthy meals and or prepare them. You know, pizzas and all those things that we see in the UK are becoming quite common in the rich sides of Africa, basically. Does that answer the question, or do you want me to elaborate some more?
No, that answers the question for Africa. And I'm looking a little bit about what's happening in Trinidad and Tobago. I've just started thinking about it, but you have in the Caribbean, right, just like in Africa, but perhaps more here, this culture of valuing imported food as well, and not the local food as much, but I think that that's changing now. So the food regime that's happening in the US and the UK, this green capitalism, whatever you want to call it, yes, which is associated with the upper levels, you know, yes, and they're spending more money on health food and gyms and whatever. Absolutely. It's not quite happened yet elsewhere, and that's the kind of questions that I'm looking at. Okay?
That's interesting, because even in Nigeria, it's the same, because even a poor person would strive to eat those meals because they feel the wealthy can do it, so they too can do it, especially if they live in the urban areas as well.
The second question on genetics?
Okay, in genetics, and you said also about facilities for the poor. In terms of genetics, actually I had a slide about the complexity of the factors that have been associated with obesity. Genetics is definitely one of them. It's important to consider that there are various risk factors. Some of them are individual, gender, genetics being some of those. But then there are modifiable risk factors, which include the environment, the ability to exercise, and all such things. Obviously, your basal metabolic rate could also be affected by your genes as well. So there is that. I was recently conducting a focus group study of people from sub-Saharan Africa living in the UK, and one of the points that came up as well, actually from one of the participants, was that sometimes it's not so much that there are, the genetics is an issue, but habits. Also, you know, people within a family have certain habits, and therefore, beyond the actual genes, the habitual eating and loving food is also a problem. In terms of what facilities exist for the less socially upward mobile people, lower SES status in the UK, the government is trying. For example, there are free gyms, free access to gyms for people who are obese. The problem, however, with that is they wait till they already have a problem before providing that service, rather than treating them from an early stage. Okay. At a stage in Medway, they actually said all children under 16 should have free sort of access to the gym. But with the new conservative government and realization that there is the problem with the economics, mm-hmm. that was scrapped. So it's a big issue. They resort to drugs, which is not the solution. For example, one of the work I did was with pharmacists as an alternative, a paradigm shift. I can't remember the tech. You gave us a word yesterday, which, okay, I have to learn that. Where pharmacists actually provide weight management services, and that has helped a lot because they can identify the people who come in, well people who don't have a problem yet, but they can see the potential, opportunistically screen them, pick them up and encourage them and tell them about other ways they can exercise without going to the gym. So they don't have to go to the gym, but they just have to be able to think of other creative ways to burn the energy and compare their intake to their expenditure. Thank you.
Thank you, Fumi. We have another question at the back, Mrs. Lewis, and also our friend from Trinidad. Is there another question? This is, yes, okay. Yes. Go right ahead.
Okay. I'm looking at the sustaining the future well-being of our children, and the point of time poverty was mentioned. And you find most working parents are unable probably in the morning to prepare breakfast or even lunch packages for their kids. But I am thinking that diabetes, I'm using the word, I find it very interesting, is not a family problem, but a societal problem. And I think the time has come where there need to be a policy in school feeding programs, where the foods that we give our children are healthy. The children get to school, they get the sodas, the same fatty foods that we say, you know, do not prepare at home. They get into the classrooms, and that's the same things that they get. So I think that, and I'm also thinking that it's no longer a St. Lucia problem, a Dominica problem, but let's look at it on a CARICOM basis. What can we do? How can we approach this problem collectively? And maybe at the end of the day, it will be more beneficial and cheaper for all of us. Mm. I also looked at taxes. We talk about eating properly. It's so expensive in the Caribbean. You want to buy carrots and broccoli and this so-called good foods, and they are so expensive. However, we look at import duties on these foods as a reason for them being so costly. CARICOM, we have the common external tariff. We have harmonized taxes where St. Lucia cannot reduce the price of carrots. Mm-hmm. Because of this policy we have in place. Yeah. So there again, if we look at it collectively on a CARICOM basis, then it will benefit all of us. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very well said. In the UK, they now have, well, as part of the NICE guidelines, they have policies for schools, for workplaces, and one of them is the healthy schools policy, where the school must provide healthy meals for students. But not all schools are adopting the healthy schools policy.
Okay, thank you. And just to mention a bit on your comments, I'm sure a couple of decades ago we knew of the watercress. I remember going to the farm and you have dashing leaves. I don't even know the value of that, you know, Callaloo. All those kinds of greens and what have you, and those things will. You know, they looked like they were just traditional and not nutritional. And now that we have to import the broccoli and the carrots and the cauliflower, and those things probably, a lot of them have just faded. And, you know, some of them just come around during the Junequeol celebration. And these were the foods that we should have been taught to eat, you know, until we become seniors, and that wasn't done, so hence the problem here. We have a question from, yes, two questions.
Well, okay, I am from Trinidad. We have to stand? No,
okay. That's okay. I think we family now.
Okay, the last speaker, Trinidad and Tobago. Yeah, right. And I got a glare with it as well. My humble apologies. The last speaker indicated that, you know, it was being seen as a social issue. Mm-hmm. I see it more leaning as a political issue. Mm-hmm. Because when you think of it, we are what we eat. Because what is common to all three speakers, and especially because when you think about it, Dr. St. Bernard dealt with the first end. Absolutely. This is breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. Dindial dealt with chronic non-communicable, which is affecting mostly the elders. Mm-hmm. Mostly, I'm not saying only. That is at the other end. And then you are in between. Okay, so it is a spectrum from mm-hmm. cradle to grave.
That's right.
And there is politics in it. I remember buying a book, The Politics of Meat. Mm. I haven't read it yet, but it was just curious.
That's the title.
It piqued my curiosity. But what I'm looking at is, we have to look at the thing in a holistic, comprehensive way. It nothing happened by accident. So I am looking at the dialectic between a exchange value and use value. Mm-hmm. When we do things, we are in a context now where people are on trade exchange value. What's in this for me?
Absolutely.
So when we take the breastfeeding, which was old time, old school training, now we are in a world of superhighway hyperspace speed. That is your poverty of time. With the breastfeeding, when we look at Trinidad and Tobago, who is having these babies? These are children having children. So there is suddenly a sort of exotic thing about being pregnant. They are bearing a toy. You know, yes, it will move. Yes, it may need diaper change and all of it, but they are not seeing that thing is going to grow.
Yes.
So we have this huge proliferation now of very young people. It is not seen as statutory rape. They are having the babies. How the challenge is, how is Dr. St. Bernard and others going to educate them when the mindset, a speaker spoke about mindset in Singapore. That's what brought about their change. It was a mindset change. How do we move that challenge for these young people? Because a grandmother now in Trinidad is 25.
Yes.
So you have the children making children, and they are not seeing. And then breastfeeding means, because we are so much onto the physical, that it will affect the shape of my bust and my breast, which is style.
Yeah.
So there is a politics undercurrent.
Absolutely.
Good. And you're aiming at the female, yes. The male is kind of in the background. And then there are more women. The chronic disease, non-communicable, are all lifestyle.
Yes.
All. Yet we will find the food on the campuses. At tertiary level, when you need most of your neurotransmitters firing and brain food, the biggest cafeteria is KFC and the Diet Coke to kill the brain.
Precisely.
Why can't you get rid of them? They may be sponsoring a chair on the campus. So the politics, that is like Marlboro sponsoring Wimbledon.
Yep.
So they will be allowed to stay because green. Not the green we're thinking of as in eco. You understand?
Absolutely.
So you are trying to educate against a current that is working in direct incongruence to what you're about.
Precisely.
So that the politics and the whole thing and the economics is we want to kill them slowly. Because none of us getting out of life alive. We gonna be dead anyway. But in the meanwhile, have pleasure in dying. So that you will be eating the things that are palatable.
Absolutely.
But not good for you. And when I was studying and doing African American, the Black American experience, they said when you go into the projects, at every street corner, there is the fast food, the barber, the funeral parlor, and the rum shop. Because you're going to hit each one. And I remember that because it is built in to the system. And that's what capitalism, part of capitalism is about. So I think, look, listening to all three, we have to up the ante a bit and look at who is really benefiting from all of us remaining sick, remaining with these chronic diseases. Because rather than fix the chronic illness, what is coming out of it now, our industry seeing about walking devices. You now have to buy things to help. We are not fixing the cause, which is down at a cellular level.
Absolutely.
You got it?
Yes.
So all three speakers speak of the life course perspective, but it is just that is who is benefiting from all of us remaining obese, becoming obese, because we're looking at preventative rather than reactive.
Yeah.
But it is who is benefiting. And that is the part that will always remain kind of nebulous.
Excellent, excellent comments. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. It's your turn now. Could you this thing? And then it would be.
Consolidated Forest, I'm presenting on breastfeeding. You made some conclusion, which I want to clear up. Graduate mothers tend to breastfeed more than those with primary education? Or are you saying that graduate mothers or students who actually are breastfeed, they go on to become graduates? And those who don't breastfeed, they only can achieve maybe a primary education? I want to clear that up, you know.
Okay.
Because what I'm linking is that graduate mothers, most of them, I think, should be working mothers, while those with a primary education, maybe semi-working or not working, they should have more time for breastfeeding than the graduate mothers who are working mothers. So I want you to clear that. I'm not too sure what was the conception of that. And the second question on the diabetes is what you eat is important. Or remember in the Caribbean or many parts of the world, is what you produce you eat. And if you look in the Caribbean, the food, the staple that we produce, you know, the dasheen, the yam, the potatoes, you know, they are high in the carbohydrate, which actually, you know, will change into, you know, simple sugar, which assists in the diabetes mellitus. So basically, we need to change that aspect in the agriculture sector, and that is very important than just top, you know, covering the top. But the root of the problem is very, very, very important to solve, you know, issues like that. Thank you.
Okay, we'll have one more question before you respond. Yes. Microphone, please.
So. Hi, everybody. Good afternoon. Rosanna Glasgow, Enfield student at International Relations in St. Augustine. Referring to the young lady when she spoke about the type of food that children eat, and she said it's more a societal problem than a family problem, I tend to disagree a little too, because it starts at the home. Because, like, I remember, I'm a single mother, but I remembered when my son was going to school, corn kernels and the juices were out. It was definitely out. And even though we are busy, we as mothers have to understand from now what we put into our children is the impact. Because if you look at, I was looking at television recently about how many little kids are getting cancer at an early age. And are we asking, what are we feeding them? Even when we are pregnant, what are we eating and what are we drinking? So it starts from there. And as Dr. Rouse rightfully said, it's a whole political thing. Because even when you spoke about the whole issue about the tax and everything, my question is, why is our food bill so huge? When we could be exporting and importing from each other right in the Caribbean. And it comes back to the politics again. How serious are we about agriculture? And we in Trinidad know that is talk upon talk upon talk. And then there's the argument that importing is cheaper than, you know, buying from your farmers. But then again, at the end of the day, we talk about food security recently. And I think even last night when we were by Derek Walcott's place there, somebody remarked, and when we travel, for me particularly, when I travel and go to a country, I want to taste the country's thing. I don't want macaroni pie.
You know, I mean, with all due respect, I understand, you know, who you're catering for. But how much are we going to continue with always copying and imitating things that don't work for us? Even when we listen to some of the comments Professor Vaughan Lewis said this morning, when are we going to reach at that stage? And then again, it has to do with the political will. Because when the politicians come to us and tell us A, B, or C, we don't say anything. So until we get politicians who say the right thing, that we follow the right thing. But then again, my other question is to the panel, when we are exposed to this taste from outside, how are we going to revert to local?
Okay, I will just allow, the next round of questioning, you will. Oh, just a comment. Okay, right.
I just wanted to say something in relation to what Mr. Singh said, and I am disagreeing with him about what we produce and the dashin and the yam. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what our grandparents ate. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Singh, you know, these things are, how they call it, complex carbs, and our body deals with it a lot better than if we were to import the pasta and everything. But what I think, my grandmother died at 96, and she ate her dashi, her sweet potato, and her yam. What and happened was milk. That she worked in her farm, so she was very active.
Yeah,
what has happened now
farm.
Is that we have a culture of being extremely lazy. Mm. Nobody wants to walk to even the bus stop anymore. We want our children want to be driven to school. Nobody wants to walk. Or after school, go on the beach, take a swim. No, people have just become extremely lazy. So it's not about our yam and our dashing. And I also wanted to make the point that we focus on grapes and strawberries, and but right here we have our golden apples, our guavas, high in vitamin C. We have local oranges, so we don't have the excuse of not necessarily being able to afford the good food. It's what we've chosen to eat, and the perception that we have created that imported food is better than what we have locally. Thank you,
Suzanne. Well said. Okay, Dr. St. Bernard will respond to Mr. Singh on the clarification, and then Fumi.
Okay, I think I understand the source of your confusion. But what I was really looking at, I'm looking first of all at, remember, children are the unit of analysis. I mean, children under 2 years. And I'm saying for those children who have been still breastfed, a greater proportion of those come from among educated mothers who have had university level education than you would find when you look at the similar situation among mothers who would have had lower levels of education. So that if you take all the women who had university level education, you would find that for those who still breastfed their kids, greater proportions among them fed those kids adequately than would be the case if you were to look at mothers with low levels of education and those who still breastfed their kids, how many of them adequately breastfed them. And what I'm basically saying is that it speaks to the fact that among those educated women, they are among a committed few who really understand the recommended standards, what they are about, and so on, and they have stuck to their guns in a major way, and it says volumes for education in that regard. In terms of the other issue you spoke of, what I was then looking at is lifetime exposure to breastfeeding among those children under 2 years. And what I was saying, when you look at, you know, the proportion that had never been breastfed, right, what you would find is that it is greater among those with higher levels of education than those with lower levels of education, which is consistent with what you might have been thinking in terms of your thoughts on the issue. So I don't know if that clears it up somewhat. But I think, you know, in terms of the presentation generally, you know, I think far and wide about a lot of things. And what comes to mind immediately with all of this is the whole question of fertility decline in Caribbean societies. Although we see lots of pregnant women, many countries in the Caribbean are below replacement fertility level at this point. But that is not to say that there aren't subpopulations that are still having large numbers of children. And in the region, we have not been doing fertility surveys and sexual and reproductive health surveys in the way we ought to do it in order to understand these dynamics. And these are dynamics that are going to eventually threaten our very existence. I mean, we're talking about sustainable development, but in years to come, who are going to be the taxpayers to prop us up with a growing elderly population? Because whether you like it or not, in countries at every age, people are living longer, right? But eventually, you're going to have all these elderly people up there, and who is going to prop that up? And what I'm saying is that, you know, we need to really start considering fertility dynamics. And in the sense that, you know, I keep saying, you know, I have a hunch that there are still high levels of fertility among the poorer groups, among the less educated folk in society. And if they are making all of the children, then, you know, you wonder what are the attributes these children are bringing to bear upon development process. And they may be due to structural forces, they may actually be disadvantaged. And what I'm advocating perhaps may run counter to what I said initially about declining fertility. Perhaps we need to reinforce the virtues and the traditional virtues of breastfeeding, because in the literature pertaining to fertility behavior, fertility outcomes, and so on, breastfeeding subsequent to a birth actually increases the interval between births. And if that is the case, and we do, you know, espouse those kinds of virtues, perhaps what we can actually foster is a reduction in fertility among those who perhaps should not be having as many children as they're having, because structural forces and factors militate against these children perhaps having the kind of attributes that would eventually redound to the sustainable development objectives that we aspire toward. So that's just one side of it, but to just throw out something that could be sort of contentious, when I think in terms of, you know, the decline of West Indies cricket, for example, right?
That's contentious.
Right? Don't be surprised if, you know, we go back to the days of the greats and so on. Perhaps the greats were breastfed, very well breastfed. The younger ones these days perhaps are not, and I think it dovetails with all of the other issues about fast food and obesity and so on. So I rest my case.
Okay, we'll take this one as anecdotal. Okay, we might just do one last round of questioning. It has been indicated that lunch would be, lunch is served. And there was supposed to be a session before lunch, but for some reason or the other, we all went overboard. Yes, there's supposed to be transportation studies, social capital, and sustainable development. And the organizers have said that we should be able to make up for these two sessions in the afternoon, since some presenters are absent and so on and so forth. So do we have any more questions? This session is very interesting. Okay, so the presenters want to wrap up, or should I say Fumi wants to wrap up? Yes.
My final word from me, because I realize that I'm extremely passionate about obesity and I could talk about it forever. But just one word, in response to the previous questions and comments. Firstly, while it appears that I am looking more in the middle, like you said, Professor, I need to say that case-controlled studies have shown that obesity is associated with breastfeeding, and so there might be a link. However, the problem with it is confounding. For example, there are cases of low birth weight babies who end up being obese. That has also been found, fetal origins. However, with that, you know, the low birth weight babies may end up not being breastfed because they need bottles, and so many other issues come into it. In terms of the politics of obesity, I think there's actually a publication on it. And there are advocates of the fact that we are overemphasizing the issue of obesity. I mean, studies in America have countered it and said the CDC has sponsored people to say that obesity is a problem and all that. And so, you know, there's a lot of counterbalancing, but we can see, working in the field, that obesity is a problem. We can see that it is a challenge. We can see, like has been said, that people aspire to eat what is not always available. For example, in the UK, people would like, we spoke about nostalgia yesterday, people would like to eat food from their native country. Sometimes these are processed and dried. They're not the same as when they are being bought here. For example, even vegetables. So they lose their flavor. But there's the issue of acculturation, trying to adapt and eat what is available and fresh in the UK. Not to say that that is cheap, but it's relatively cheaper. So the issues are so complex. I could talk about it forever. I had to focus on one subject, and that's why I chose that. An aging population, I have to say, it's also an issue, because as obesity increases, we already know that age is associated with increasing cardiovascular diseases and diabetes. That's another risk factor, independent risk factor for diabetes. So with the increase in obesity and increase in the aging population, we're likely to see even more diabetes coming up. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anything that you'd like to say, Mr. Ramratan?
Just like to add, with regards to the question on the type of food, we have to remember there are many other variables we are considering with regards to, well, to keep the focus on diabetes. The lifestyle change that has been taking place throughout the Caribbean, and especially Trinidad, is where we see persons living the more sedentary lifestyle. The youths back in the day, you would remember walking down the road, there was cricket, football on the road. Now is the latest PSP or PS2 that they would be pushing around with. So we have all these variables that as a country, as a region, we need to focus on. So yes, the food is one, but if we reduce the high salt, high caloric foods, that's one aspect. But at the same time, we have to be controlling for the type of lifestyle we are living and the increased presence of carbon dioxide emissions. We can't negate all these other factors with regards to pollution. Because there was one UN study done that had a link with cancer and the level of pollution within a particular city in China. So we have to remember that what we need to do is start doing the proper assessment of our economies, of our countries, because I think this is where we are failing to take the proper first step.
Okay. Thank you, presenters. Thank you, audience. This has been a very beneficial session. And we'll now head for lunch. Bon appetit.